Okay, it's about time for us to get started. I don't see anybody online yet, but that's all right. When it comes to this kind of video, at this particular time of day, I understand that a lot of us have a lot going on now. There's Terry Fagan, hey. And so this is gonna be published live and then it'll be able to be viewed after the fact. So if you need more content, if you'd like to be a part of the Bible study going on, that's happening right now, that would be great. This is, again, kind of an impromptu thing. I began it last week because I love this text a lot, not because it's necessarily important, per se. It's not going to change your spirituality really at all. It doesn't really impact us when it comes to any of this information. But it is an interesting text, and that in and of itself is pretty interesting to me. Because it's got some weird stuff in here, and it's in the Bible. It's for our learning to better understand the time in which Elijah and Elisha lived, and it's got some cool little stories in here. So if you were not with us last week, the video is available if you want to go back and watch that. If you don't remember, we began in the book of 2 Kings chapter 1, and we read through what it was like during the time of Elijah when the kings were basically all corrupt and the kingdoms were facing impending captivity in a couple of generations, and things were not going well. You had a divided kingdom that had idolatry in the north and the south, really. And then you had the cycle of communication between God and his people Israel was broken because God would speak through his prophets. And there was a handful of prophets, it looks like, that were actually doing what the Lord told them to do. And the rest were just kind of prophets, per se, that were telling the kings and the princes what they wanted to hear, including like Baal is okay to worship and all that kind of stuff. So they'd gone off the path a good long while. And so anyway, that broke down because the people didn't really know how to react or respond to God. The prophets... the priests, rather, that were supposed to be offering sacrifices weren't doing that well either. They were still technically offering animal sacrifices to God, but it wasn't the best, and it wasn't to him alone. So they were missing the mark when it comes to that. So last week, we talked about Elijah and his response to a king who is going to go ask Baal if he was going to recover from a fall. Elijah stopped the messengers and basically told the king, you know, you are missing the mark so much, you're not going to recover from that fall through the lattice that, you know, caused internal injuries, no doubt, and other issues. And then you have Elijah being taken up to heaven in a whirlwind. Elisha takes up his mantle, which is a phrase that we use kind of metaphorically, right? Taking up someone's mantle is kind of like taking someone's spot, filling in for someone. You know, the next generation passing down that responsibility, but taking up his mantle in that context literally meant picking up his belt. So he's literally wearing the belt of Elijah, and now Elisha is the main prophet. And then we kind of are introduced in that text, chapter 3, about the idea of the school of the prophets, and technically it's called the sons of the prophets in the text. And so a group of guys that are also prophets along with Elisha, and they're being taught by him, it seems like. They're living almost in like a communal society, we're going to figure out in this particular session today. And one big moment that happened was you had one of the sons of the prophets, he dies, and there is a great debt that he left behind. And so the widow comes to Elisha and says, "Can you help me?" basically. And Elisha says, "What do you have? Because I've only got a small little jar of oil, olive oil, to give. And they're going to take my children away to pay off the debt and make them slaves. So help me, please." And so a miracle occurs in which they borrow a bunch of pots and vessels and jars and containers. And from this one little jar of oil, they fill up, of course, all the contents of these vessels. And they sell that, and then they pay off their debt and live on that for a while. So that's kind of a cool story, a cool miracle that occurred. The second one was a bit longer in its scope, but it was basically you have a woman who is going out of her way to take care of Elisha as he travels through the land. Like, she feeds him and gives him water and gives him a place to rest. And then they actually make a room, like with walls and a bed and a door. So whenever he's going through, he can just stop in there and rest with his friends. And that was very kind. And so what Elisha does is he wants to bless her and gives her a son, even though she's past the age of bearing children. And so the son is born, and that's a huge, huge deal. And then it continues on by the son one day going out to the field. He's crying about his head, and then he just dies, right? That's a crazy situation, very emotional. And so the woman tells the husband everything is fine, which it's not, and goes to get Elisha and says, I told you not to get my hopes up about having a son. Not all is well with him. Elisha sends on Gehazi, his servant, with his staff to, if he's just injured, we would think the staff could cure him or heal him through God's power, but he's actually dead. So what happens is Elisha, as he's stretching out and mirroring the figure of the boy by laying on top of him, and then, you know, he comes back to life and everything's good. So that's where we left off. Again, wild stuff, right? I mean, it's not just like a normal, you know, okay, so Jesus feeds the 5,000 and then he rebukes them later because they came to him for bread and not because he was the living bread. That's a bit more pertinent for us, right? Not to go to Jesus just to have your needs met, but to go to him because, you know, he is the source of life. That's a bit more pertinent to us. This is not. It's similar in a lot of ways. And there is a lot of similarities between the work of Elijah and Elisha and the work of John the Baptist and Jesus. And that's definitely on purpose. Really what's being said there is that in the New Testament, they had not had a prophet like these two guys in a long time, 400 years, right? So four or five generations. They're in captivity. They're under Roman occupation in the first century. And then Jesus comes along and he's doing things like Elijah and like Elisha, and hope is reborn, but much more important hope, because it's not just a physical nation, now it's a spiritual kingdom. So that's kind of the big picture, right? Remember, one more connecting dot here, remember that the appearance of John the Baptist was that he was hairy, right? Like, he was wearing hair, wearing fur. He had a leather belt around his waist. He was living out in the wilderness, surviving off of locusts and wild honey, right? So you get the same imagery of John the Baptist is the new Elijah, because that's what he was like, right? And that's Malachi chapter 3. There's going to be the Elijah's coming back, and that's John the Baptist, Jesus said in his text as well. So, okay, anyway, we're going to be picking it up here in the book of 2 Kings, chapter 4, verse 38 is that next story. And this is one of the wild ones that is just, I mean, there's no real meaning behind it to me spiritually, but it's just kind of a cool story. So here we go. That's as large as font as I can make it on the screen. If you cannot read that, I can't help you anymore with that. So just pull out your Bible and follow along. Once again, it's 2 Kings chapter 4, verse 38. Okay. And Elisha came to Gilgal, where there was a famine in the land. And as the sons of the prophets were sitting before him, he said to his servant, set out a large pot and boil stew for the sons of the prophets. So there's a famine going on. Remember from the book of like Joel and Hosea, the famines were sent to Israel to try to get them to wake up to the reality of them not living correctly. He sent them pestilences and plagues and famines and droughts to try to get them to realize that things are not going well. What can we change? What can we adapt and make new that will enhance or bring about God's blessing once again? So during one of those times, you've got Elisha and the school or the sons of the prophets, and they're hungry. So like, let's make a communal meal. Let's make a big pot of stew. Verse 39, one of them went out to the fields to gather herbs, and found a wild vine and gathered from it his lap full of wild gourds and came and cut them up into the pot of stew, not knowing what they were. So this is not like you're going down to Walmart or Target or Publix and getting your groceries, right, to make a big, nice pot of stew. They're going out there and they're foraging for wild stuff. And so you got a guy who's getting gourds, that's safe, finds a wild vine, apparently not safe. Verse 40, and they poured out some for the men to eat, but while they were eating of the stew, they cried out, O man of God, there is death in the pot, and they could not eat it. Well, and I think the King James is a bit funnier, like there was death in the pot, and it's a bit more Shakespearean. Basically, what they're saying, obviously, is this, there's poison in here. We can't eat this food now, so we've wasted our time and our resources to go and make this pot of stew for everyone to eat, and it's poisonous, so now we can't. And it's kind of like the story we read last week about the water that was undrinkable and it was causing people to die. And so they, you know, in Bethel, they asked him to purify the water. He throws some salt in there from a new bowl. That in and of itself would not do anything, but because of God's miracle, it purified the water, right? And then the author of the text said, you know, it's still good water even to this day. So who knows how long that was. So verse 41, in a similar way, he says, then bring flour, right? So flour, we know what flour is. That would not purify poisonous stew, right? That's kind of the point. He says, they threw it in the pot, and he said, pour some out for the men that they may eat. And there was no harm in the pot. So the poison was cured by this magical, miracle flour that was thrown in there. If you've ever made stew before, I mean, you know, if you want to thicken it up, you know, you can throw some flour in there, but it also gets kind of clumpy too, right? So that's not going to be the actual thing that cured it, obviously. You have God working through Elisha here to meet this need that they had for food during a famine sent by God to correct the people that were in sin. So, you know, big picture here, God's taking care of his people. Is it kind of a weird story? Yeah, that's why we're reading it. It's not normal, but it's interesting to kind of see it from that perspective, right? Okay, so verse 42. A man came from Baal Shalisha. There you go. It's a good one for you. Bringing the man of God bread of the first fruits, 20 loaves of barley, and fresh ears of grain in his sack. And Elisha said, give to the men that they may eat. But his servant said, how can I set this before 100 men? So he repeated, give them to the men that they may eat, for thus says the Lord, they shall eat and have some left. Does this sound familiar to you? I really hope so, because this is exactly what Jesus did with feeding the 5,000 and the 4,000, or 3,000 rather, right? Verse 44, so he set it before them, and they ate and had some left according to the word of the Lord. That's what I'm trying to say is, the more you kind of look at Elijah and Elisha, the more you see why Jesus and John did what they did when it comes to performing miracles. It's because if you grew up in your synagogue in, you know, Israel in the first century, and you are rolling through the book of Kings in your scrolls, and you hear this story, it's going to stand out into your mind. And then when you go to Galilee and you see Jesus doing this stuff, you're like, this guy's from God. I get the picture. So that's kind of the idea of what we're seeing here. Anyway, so verse 40, nope, that's it. 44 is it. So he set it before them. They ate and had some left according to the word of the Lord. So that's one set of crazy story. We get a more well-known story next in chapter 5. This is the one that we go to talk about Naaman, who is a commander of the army of the king of Syria, but he's a leper. So we'll pick this up and we'll read it. I'm not going to do a whole sermon, obviously. I have a sermon on Naaman. If you really want to hear it, you can go through the videos on my page on Facebook. You can go to my my podcast that's just audio, which is www.alanhornbuckle.podbean.com. That's available also as a link from my website, alanhornbuckle.com. just a kind of a plug there in case you don't know about those two resources that you can use. I've got years and years worth of sermons on there, so if you're ever really hankering for an Allen sermon, there you go. All right, so Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, a great man with his master and in high favor, because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. He was a mighty man of valor. So our equivalent to this I've mentioned before kind of textually is he was special forces, right? He was one of the guys that was out there, the tip of the spear. He was doing wild stuff, and God gave him the victory. But he was a leper, right? So leprosy is a plague. It is a disease that one can get. At the end stage of leprosy, not only are you highly contagious, but you're also not going to live a long time. And at the same time that you're doing that, you're going to have body parts, soft tissue that are going to disintegrate and rot off. A huge, huge deal. And leprosy, that which eats from the inside out, another way to say that would be in the text, is symbolic really of sin, right? So when you have a person who is a leper in the tribe of Israel or the land of Israel, they have to put them outside of the camp to allow that disease not to spread. And then Paul will talk about that in a similar way, talking about sin in the church. So anyway, verse 2. Now the Syrians, on one of their raids, had carried off a little girl from the land of Israel, and she worked in the service of Naaman's wife. Now the reality of this here is she was taken slave, right? That's a big deal. We don't have that really culturally today. Mainstream, I'm sure it's happening around the world at some point, taking children and raising them as slaves or servants in cultures, but it's not common in our culture, right? But that was her life. That was her reality. So being sensitive to that, look at this, verse 3. She said to her mistress, or her slave owner, "Would that my lord were with the prophet who's in Samaria. He would cure him of his leprosy." Now, this is kind of famous because we don't know this little girl's name. We don't know how old she really was in verse 3 compared to verse 2. We don't know if she enjoyed her life, but she knew about the prophet Elijah or Elisha in Samaria, and that he was able to perform these great deeds. So that's interesting that she knew about him. And then verse 4 and following, they go and send a messenger from the king of Syria to the king of Israel, saying, "Hey, can you cure our commander of leprosy?" That's kind of like a favor, I guess. And then the king is like losing his mind because he has no idea what kind of threat this is, what kind of game he's playing. We can't cure leprosy or whatever. And then verse 8. But when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, he sent to the king saying, "Why have you torn your clothes? Let him now come to me that he may know that there is a prophet in Israel." So the king doesn't know the solution, but Elisha does. And he's using this situation as an opportunity to show an outside nation that there's a prophet of the one and true God in Israel. And also, I would suspect, he's trying to show the king, hey, yeah, you can't cure leprosy, but God can. Wouldn't it be great if you had a better relationship with him that he would work through you too? Think about King David. I mean, David was a good king, but he was not a perfect man. He was, you know, obviously human, obviously fallible. And at the end of the day, all the good things that David did were through God, right? So you look at the book of Psalms, for example, he came to a lot of his decision-making processes. It all came down to going to God. And so, again, Elisha's trying to make that point, I feel, strongly to the king and also to Syria and Naaman. So Naaman came with his horses and chariots and stood at the door of Elisha's house. So he has a house. It's pretty cool. Elisha sent a messenger to him saying, "Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored, and you shall be clean." So if you're the commander of the king of the army of Syria's military forces, you're not usually met with just a messenger sent to you when you're coming to make a big hubbub with the man who's going to cure your leprosy. Just getting the message from a messenger is not really what he expected. Verse 11, but Naaman was angry, and he went away, saying, behold, I thought he would surely come out to me and stand and call upon the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the place and cure the leper. So he had expectations that were not realistic, right? I've mentioned in that sermon before, I mentioned about Naaman, that sometimes we have this when it comes to how we think things are going to happen versus how God allows them to happen. There can be a huge difference between those two things. And when we come to God and asking for his blessing, his grace, his peace, whatever we need from the Lord, we have to let it be on his terms, right? It doesn't really matter what we think things are going to look like, because God is working, not us. And so he says, look, are not Abana and Tephar, the rivers of Damascus, better than the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be clean? Well, no, because God said Jordan. So he turned and went away in a rage. And look at this, verse 13. But his servants came near and said, my father, or my lord, is it a great word the prophet has spoken to you? Will you not do it? Has he actually said to you, wash and be clean? So he's saying, look, I mean, you know, it's not a big deal. We can just go down there, do it, and see what happens. So then verse 14, he went down, dipped himself seven times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God. His flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. So again, this is probably the most well-known Elisha story. It has a lot of meaning, a lot of text, but I've talked about this a lot, so let's move forward. This is the one that we don't often mention. I sometimes do, if I have time. Verse 15, he returned to the man of God, he and all his company, and he came and stood before him, and he said, behold, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. So accept now a present from your servant. So you got to respect this, right? He went away angry because what he expected did not come to pass. He did what God told him to do through Elisha, and he was thankful. He was so thankful, he came back and said, thank you, let me give you some gifts, you know, to repay what you've done. But he, Elisha, said, as the Lord lives, before whom I stand, I will receive none. And he urged him to take it, but he refused. So, you know, you got to kind of wonder why. One reason might be that Elisha didn't want to think that you could buy the grace of God. It's a pretty good lesson, right? I mean, the things that we do that are good works after we receive salvation, some of us, when we're more immature in the faith, we're like, well, if I just work hard enough and convert enough people and you know, give away all the money that I can and all these nice things that we should be doing, if I just do enough of that, then we'll be even, or I'll be earning what I got. And that was a problem all the way in the first century, right? Paul talks about the grace of God not being able to be earned, not works of our salvation, for good reason, because people thought that way and people do think that way. And really what we're doing here is we're trying to realize that when God gives a gift, he wants you to receive that gift. And as we know in the book of 1 Corinthians, Paul talks about Jesus telling him in special direct revelation, it is better to give than to receive, right? Now, we don't find that in Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. So by Paul saying that that was what Jesus said, he's saying, Jesus told me it's better to give than to receive. And we understand that, right? We feel bad when people give us things that we don't deserve or do nice things for us. We don't want to feel that kind of social debt or obligation. But when you give a gift to somebody, how does that make you feel, right? It feels good to help people. That's part of the why God, when he gives us nice things and we feel guilty about it, we got to kind of see it from his perspective too. You know, we have children, my wife and I, as you know, And we love giving them surprises, right? And it just makes their day, and their face lights up, and they're thankful, and they may forget about it in 5 minutes from when we actually give them the gift or whatever it is, candy or a cookie. But, you know, giving someone something that they appreciate, it's a big deal. It's a great blessing, a part of life. And no doubt God feels that way, caring for us as his children. We can't pay him back. That's not the point. So, anyway, verse 17. Then Naaman said, "If not, please let there be given to your servant 2 mule loads of earth, for from now on your servant will not offer burnt offering or sacrifice to any god but the Lord." All right, so basically what he's saying is I want to bring the earth, the dirt of Israel, back with me. So when I give offerings to the Lord, I can do it on Israel's earth to him alone. He's basically saying, I want to convert. I want to be a God worshiper, which is a pretty good deal. Verse 18, "In this matter, may the Lord pardon your servant when your master goes into the house of Rimmon to worship there, leaning on my arm, and I bow myself in the house of Rimmon. When I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon your servant in this matter." He said, "Go in peace." So, this is kind of a big deal, I think. You can take this too far, if you already know what this is kind of setting up here. But he's basically saying, I can't fully proselyte into being a Jew. I can't leave my army. I can't leave my king. And I have to go and worship Rimmon, the god of Damascus, with my people. But when I have to do that, I want the Lord to forgive me. Again, you can kind of see the danger here. If you look at this one issue, especially away from the overall context of the scriptures, you have people that might ask something like, well, you know, I've got a family that worships in a church that's not worshiping correctly. But I want to worship correctly, so I want the Lord to forgive me when I worship in a sinful way. Well, I mean, obviously, in the New Testament, we find so many verses that contradict that theory, that thought. So what the text says here is what the text says here. God was speaking through Elisha in verse 19. He gave him pardon. But this situation, away from the overarching context, cannot be used to prove that you can kind of basically do whatever you want out of convenience, and then just have God's forgiveness. That's not what the New Testament teaches whatsoever. So hopefully that's clear to you. Okay, so when Naaman had gone from him a short distance, remember the guy, Gehazi the servant, that was given the staff of Elisha to go run ahead quickly and try to bring the Shunammite's woman back to sons back to life? Well, that same guy, Gehazi, verse 20, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, "See, my master has spared this Naaman, the Syrian, and not accepting from his hand what he brought. As the Lord lives, I will run after him and get something from him." Well, I mean, I don't know, man. Like, Gehazi, you'd think that, you know, living with Elisha, working with him for all this time, that Elisha would know, right? But you also look at people in Jesus' life, and you're like, Peter, you've been with Jesus for 3.5 years now. If he tells you that before the rooster crows, you're going to deny him 3 times, and you're like, "No, Lord, I'll die for you," you'd think that he'd know better too. So, I don't know. It's a weird situation. Verse 21. So Gehazi followed Naaman. When Naaman saw someone running after him, he got down from the chariot to meet him and said, "Is all well?" I love this little detail here. He says, "Is everything good?" Because what that shows me is his attitude has completely changed from when he got there to where when he refused to go to the Jordan because it didn't make any sense to him, to now he goes and wants to worship the Lord. That shift, I mean, that's so powerful because it shows us that he was capable of change and disposition. He was that changed because he was cured of a spirit, of a physical disease, how much more should we change because we are cured of a spiritual disease of sin that leads to eternal death? You know what I mean? That's the parallel here for us. So that's powerful to me. I got so many emails coming in. What in the world? Excuse me just for 1 minute. All right. Nothing important. Okay. Verse 22. He said, "All is well. My master has sent me to say, there have now come to me from the hill country of Ephraim two young men of the sons of the prophets." So, you know, you get more context, more detail here about the sons of the prophets. Apparently they were sent on missions. It's pretty cool. It's not true, of course, but the story kind of tells us that in context. "Please give them a talent of silver and two changes of clothing." He said, "Be pleased to accept two talents." He urged him. He tied up two talents of silver in two bags and two changes of clothing and laid them on two of his servants, and they carried them before Gehazi. So Gehazi's like, "All right, well, you know, I'm not going to ask for a lot. I'll just get two talents, you know, 200 pounds of silver," or whatever it turns out to be. I forget the talent conversion, but a lot of silver and change of clothes. "When he came to the hill, he took them from their hand and put them in the house. He sent the men away and they departed." I don't know what the situation was like, obviously, besides what we read here, but, you know, he had to be a little nervous walking into camp with Naaman's servants, being like, "I've got stuff that Gehazi said that you know, Elisha wanted," and then, you know, he's not busted yet. And then verse 25, "He went in and stood before his master." Elisha said to him, "Where have you been, Gehazi?" Like, you know what's going to happen here, but it reminds me so much of the book of Genesis, when Adam and Eve, they're now in sin. They've eaten from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They know they're naked. They have that shame. And then the Lord is walking through the garden in the cool of day, you know, enjoying his creation with his shining creation, mankind, giving them the free will and choice to live there with him in peace forever, or to carve their own path through sin that leads towards death, you know, and we make that choice. But in the garden, the Lord said, "Adam, where are you?" Right? It's not like the Lord didn't know where he was, physically or spiritually. But by asking the question, sometimes it can get people to kind of think about it in a bit different way, right? That's powerful. He says, "Where have you been, Gehazi?" He says, "Nowhere." You know, that's just funny to me, because who's he trying to fool here, right? The Lord, Elisha himself, you know, he's not been nowhere. He just showed back up, right? So anyway, verse 26. "He said to him, 'Did not my heart go with when the man turned from his chariot to meet you? Was it a time to accept money and garments, olive orchards and vineyards, sheep and oxen and slaves?'" So that's kind of the answer as to why did he not receive the gift. He goes, "It's not time for that." Nationally and personally, the issue was not money and blessings. It was the fact that there was a nation of people that turned their back on God, and according to the covenant that their forefathers agreed to, and they agreed to by being part of the Israelite nation, they had condemnation coming. They had curses coming. It's not time to take blessings from a foreign military commander, right? It's like Ecclesiastes says, there's a time for everything in the seasons of life, a time to live, a time to die, time, all these things. There's a time for each of these things in life. It wasn't time to take his gifts. So anyway, verse 27, here's the consequence. "Therefore, the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and to your descendants forever." So he went out from his presence, a leper, white as snow. Man. It's a heavy consequence, right? To have your body being eaten by this disease. I think most importantly in verse 27, that leprosy didn't just affect Gehazi, but it affected all the descendants of Gehazi, implying that he had a family too. We sometimes get questions like, well, how is that just? How is that fair? For some individual to commit some grave sin before God and God to punish him and then others for that action. It's a couple of occasions like that in the Bible, right? Where the family suffers the consequences. Maybe even the whole tribe suffers the consequences for the actions of maybe one man. And I think there's a very important lesson in there that we need to remind ourselves of often. When it comes to our decisions, our choices, and especially when it comes to us committing sin, it does not just affect you. Yeah, you may be responsible. You're the one that made that decision. You made that choice. You gave into temptation, whatever the case may be. But it's going to affect more than just you. Think about King David for a moment before, right? David, he happened to be home, happened to look at the rooftops of the kingdom, and he saw a beautiful woman bathing, right? Now, it began with lust of the eyes, right? And he could have said, you know what? That's somebody's wife. I shouldn't be looking at that person that way. I'm going to go back inside. That could have been it, and it would have been dealt with. But no, he made the decision and says, all right, I'm going to send my servants to go get that beautiful girl or woman. Servants go to her. She could have said, no way, I'm not going to go see the king right now. I've got a husband. I got a family. Like, I'm not going to go see the king. And that could have been it right then. And that would have probably shocked David into saying, all right, I got a whole harem of women. I don't need to grab that one right there in that house, right? But it kept going. And then it became adultery and fornication. She became pregnant, right? And then the husband was out, and he was a foreigner fighting for King David. And then he tried to deceive and use deception to try to make it look like the baby was going to be the husband's, but it wasn't. And so you have the honor of the man finally saying, no, I'm not going to go back to my wife when my men are out there fighting. I'm going to go fight with them, right? And then you have David sending Joab, of all people, the message, hey, put him in the front so he gets taken out first and he dies in combat. And then they try to finagle even after that. So Nathan the prophet had to go to him and reveal what had happened. So how many people did that one king's decision affect? Well, a lot. It affected David. It affected the servants that were involved in retrieving Bathsheba. It affected Bathsheba and her family. Her husband died in the process, and it affected the curses that would come afterwards for that unborn child. The child is not going to live. And so you look at about it that way, and you can kind of understand a bit about more of the lesson. When we really have that temptation in front of us, you have to take the moment to think about how it's going to affect not just you eternally, but also the consequences here in this life. And there are so many men who can, people that can walk around with the guilt of that, but you know, that's part of it, is dealing with the consequences with God and then the consequences with our family. Okay, chapter 6. Bit heavy. Sorry, we got kind of heavy there for a second, but it's a very important lesson for us to learn, right? That's why we're here. Now we get back to the weird stories. So in chapter 6 of 2 Kings, verse 1, now the sons of the prophets said to Elisha, see, we're 40 minutes in, all right. See, the place where we dwell under your charge is too small for us. So again, we don't have a full picture here. This is just kind of getting little snapshots of what their life was like. And one of them was that they were living in a place that was kind of like a community, right? And they said, it's too small. There's too many people here. So verse 2, let us go to the Jordan, and each of us there get a log, and let us make a place for us to dwell there. He said, go. So he goes, let's build a new building, basically. Let's build a new lodge. And there, then one of them said, be pleased to go with your servants. He said, I will go. So he went with them. And when they came to the Jordan, they cut down trees. But as one was felling a log, his axe head fell into the water, and he cried, alas, my master, it was borrowed. All right, so a lot going on here. They're chopping down trees to make a house, right? They're using an axe to do so, so not easy work. And they lose the axe head when it flies off the handle and it goes into the Jordan River. So not that bad, except for the fact that they borrowed it from someone. So it seems like material possessions was kind of one of those things that they didn't really have, or maybe they just needed more than what they had. But whatever the case, that's interesting in and of itself. And then, here we go. The man of God said, where did it fall? And he showed him the place. He cut off a stick and threw it in there and made the iron float. And he said, take it up. So he reached out his hand and took it. So again, one of those things where this doesn't make any sense logically. It's got to be a miracle. Iron doesn't float generally, right? And then throwing a stick in the water doesn't make iron float. So again, another miracle. I think the King James here is a bit funnier in my mind because it says he made the iron swim, right? And it's what the King James says. And I always imagine, I don't know why, I always imagine that when he threw the stick in there, the axe head floated up and then it swam like a fish to him. Doesn't make any sense, but, you know, none of this really does. And so I like that image better from the King James. But that's just me, I guess. I think it's pretty funny. So it'd be a cool thing to be able to do, right? The point wasn't just like, hey, perform a miracle to show off. It's, of course, caring for the person that loaned them the axe. I mean, they're going to have to fix the axe and give it back to them. So anyway, again, one of those weird stories that maybe you've read before, maybe you haven't. But I hadn't read it before. I read it for the first time, and I thought it was hilarious and just odd. And so I want to share it with you. Okay, one more big one here. Verse 8. Remember that whole Syrian army guy, Naaman? Well, verse 8, once when the king of Syria was warring against Israel. So the way it's kind of said here in the English, it gives you the impression this is not chronological, right? That's not the point of it, it's being chronological here in this text. The point is just like, here's a bunch of stuff that happened that shows the power of God in this one like microcosm of Israel where you have the prophets of God and the sons of the prophets working and doing things and making an impact. And so again, once the king of Syria was warring against Israel, he took counsel with his servants, saying, at such and such a place shall be my camp. And I love the fact that the Bible has in such and such a place. But the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are going down there. Now, that's interesting as well, because now you've got a prophet of God being given special revelation from God himself about a foreign tactic to ambush the people of Israel. And Elisha sends that message to the king so he can make the change for the plan, right? So, verse 10, and the king of Israel sent to the place about which the man of God had told him, and thus he used him to warn him so that he saved himself there more than once or twice. So a couple of times, you've got God revealing through Elisha the enemy tactics to avoid death in that situation. Verse 11. And the mind of the king of Syria was greatly troubled because of this thing, and he called his servants and said to them, will you not show me who of us is for the king of Israel? And they said, none, my lord, O king, but Elisha, the prophet who's in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. What? Now we look at that, we're like, you know, in our day of technology, it's not unheard of to have listening devices hidden in someone's room, right? That was a big deal. I used to love watching James Bond when I was younger. I mean, I guess I still do. I haven't seen a good one in a little while, but it was always the coolest thing to look back at the ones from the 60s, and they would have the listening devices behind the painting that James Bond would find, and then he would ask for another room from the hotel lady or whatever. But they were just these ridiculous, you know, the size of your cell phone now, taped to the back of a painting. You're like, wow, what an invasion of privacy. I can't believe it. And then all the way back here, it's like, oh, the prophet of God is knowing what I'm saying in my bedroom. Well, you know, it's kind of funny to me to think of it that way, but at the same time, it's true about God, right? This is one thing to kind of keep in mind here is we're never truly alone and away from God, for good or bad. Meaning if we want to deceive ourselves in thinking that no one knows something that's going on, the Lord knows what's going on. And for good, because if you ever feel like you are completely alone, guess what? You're not completely alone. The Lord's right there still. So that's two sides of it. Anyway, verse 13, he said, go and see where he is, that I may send and seize him. It was told, behold, he's in Dothan. So there you go. So he sent their horses and chariots and a great army, and they came by night and surrounded the city. When the servant of the man of God, maybe Gehazi pre-leprosy, rose early in the morning and went out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city. And the servant said, alas, my master, what shall we do? What a great question, right? Now, this text has always kind of puzzled me a little bit. Because, you know, if he knows about the tactics of the enemy and where they're going to lay by an ambush for the Israelite troops, do you think Elisha didn't know this was going to happen? Did God not tell him this is going to happen? Or did he know, but he wanted the story to play out the way it did so that we could have this text? One of those great unknowable questions that I seem to run into way too often. Verse 16, Elisha said, do not be afraid, which you could just do an entire search on the times that you see that phrase, don't be afraid. Fear is such a powerful, overwhelming distraction when it comes to finding our place within the path of God, because fear will cause us to lose faith and lose trust in the one who's more powerful than whatever we're facing. Don't be afraid, because those who are with us are more than those who are with them. He didn't mean we have more troops than the Syrians. Verse 17, then Elisha prayed and said, O Lord, please open his eyes that he may see. The Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Now, I think pretty clearly, and maybe pretty obviously, in verse 17, what we're talking about here is seeing beyond this physical realm bound by space and time, and having your eyes open to the spiritual reality of what's happening just beyond our physical existence. It's interesting that when you see angelic messengers or beings, sometimes they have a flaming sword. The name angel sometimes in the Hebrew means the burning ones. Seraphim, for example, the burning snakes. And so you have this idea of fire being present, and that's going to get your attention. How was Elisha able to see this? Well, because God let him, most importantly, and he wanted his servant to see it as well. It just makes me curious, right? You know, we're all going to be here for a while, and then one day or another, we're not going to be here anymore. We're going to be beyond this physical realm bound by space and time. and we're going to be in the spiritual realm, whatever that is. And what that's going to look like, what that's going to feel like, what that's going to be, no idea. We get little glimpses here and there, and they're completely incomplete when it comes to giving us all the details we want. And that's part of the mystery, part of the joy, and part of the experience, because, you know, when you go on a trip somewhere, you may have an idea of what that trip's going to look like, but you really don't know, right? You go to a place you've never been before, you might have an itinerary, and you might know what you're going to wear each day, and if you have enough socks in your suitcase, but, you know, part of it is just being able to go through that experience and live. And part of the great joy of life is there's another life that doesn't end. And we're just prepping for that big trip. That's really it. So anyway, it excites me to read this because it was just there. It was just, you couldn't see it. So I know that there are things that happen around us all the time in the spiritual realm that we can't quantify and can't calculate and can't see or experience, but it's there. And that can be a source of great encouragement too. When we think that we're alone, we think there's no one that listens or cares or helps us, there's a lot more going on than we can fathom. So that's part of why this text is so beloved by me, is because it kind of reveals that the normal kind of day-to-day things, like making a pot of stew, like going to get a drink of water, just passing through and being hospitable to somebody, all of this has a deeper spiritual resonance to it than we may give it. Anyway, verse 18, when the Syrians came down against him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, please strike this people with blindness. So he struck them with blindness according to the prayer of Elisha. And Elisha said, this is not the way, this is not the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek. And he led them to Samaria. And as soon as they entered Samaria, Elisha said, O Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see. So the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw, and behold, they were in the middle of Samaria. And as soon as the king of Israel saw them, he said to Elisha, my father, shall I strike them down? Shall I strike them down? Ready to go? Ready to go? He said, you shall not strike them down. Would you strike down those whom you've taken captive with your sword and your bow? Set bread and water before them that they may eat and drink and go to their master. He prepared for them a great feast. When they had eaten and drunk, he sent them away, and they went to their master. And the Syrians did not come again on raids into the land of Israel. Well, absolutely not. I mean, could they have just led them to the slaughter and the king wants to kill them? Absolutely. They would lose their lives, and there might be more raids to try to capture the elusive Elisha again after this. But if they go, they treat them well, they give them food, they give them water, and send them back, they're not going to come back again. That mercy paid off dividends when it comes to treating these enemies well. And again, the obvious implication there for us is when Jesus said to love your enemies, right? This is one way in which that particular doctrine paid off well. Okay, so that's going to be it for a little bit. I think we're done for today. I appreciate you listening. I know this text is weird. I try to make it as entertaining as possible. And there are so many more stories like this. There are some stories that I wouldn't feel necessarily comfortable preaching or teaching in this kind of way because they're so sensitive, and you don't know who the audience is going to be. So I want to be concerned about that and be aware of that. So I'll just leave you with the thought that there are so many stories like this. If this is all new to you, I'm glad I could show you this kind of material. It's hidden throughout the text. If you just read it, you will find it. But if you've seen this before, hopefully I've given you some new perspectives and new thoughts about how we can apply that to our own spiritual life as well. So thank you for being here today. Thank you for watching later on, if this is after it's been posted live. And if you have any suggestions of things that you want me to talk about on Thursdays until we're back to normal, I'd be happy to do so. Just let me know, and we can talk about those things as well. I should be back here next week, next Thursday, Lord willing, to do another class for you. So I will see you then, but I'll definitely see you again on Sunday, Lord willing, for our normal worship service. So thanks again. Talk to you guys later.